get my slides going. We're going to be in verse 30 in just a minute, but I want to set the background here just a little bit again, spend just a minute on it. But remember, at the end of chapter 10, the Hebrews were told that the just live by faith. And then we said that in Hebrews chapter 11, one of the primary verses is down in verse 6, is that without faith, it is impossible to please him, speaking of God. And so we've got these two verses here. And then, and again, the Hebrew writer's reason for writing chapter 11, I believe, is that he wants to show the Hebrews that it can be done. If they're thinking about leaving Christianity because they've been persecuted or because there's some tribulation going on in their lives, and I think when we look forward to chapter 12, we'll see that's actually the case. If they're thinking about leaving, the Hebrew writer wants to give them some examples of people who have successfully navigated life, who have gone through the trials and the temptations and even the deaths sometimes that they went through, and yet they had faith. And a couple of people have pointed out to me, and it's rightly so, that we look at these people, and the Hebrews looked at Abraham and Moses as heroes, and yet Abraham and Moses both had flaws, great flaws. Abraham, twice it's recorded that he lied about Sarah being his sister instead of his wife. Moses thought he would be the deliverer, but after he had spent 40 years in the wilderness and God called him and said, I'm going to send you, Moses said, I can't talk very well. And it's funny because the Bible says that he was mighty in words and deeds 40 years earlier. But by the time he got to 80 years old, he didn't have any confidence. And God had to send Aaron along with him as a mouthpiece. And of course, at the end of Moses' life, he didn't get to go into the promised land because of the sin of striking the rock and saying, must we give you water from this rock? You can go down. We're going to talk a little bit about David. David was a man after God's own heart, and yet there is this big incident in his life where with Bathsheba, where he committed grave sin. The people in here, we'll talk about Gideon or Jephthah, or, you know, you can go down Samuel. He was a great, faithful man, but he did a lousy job raising his kids. Both of his sons were evil men. And so you've got a kind of an interesting thought here, is that obviously faith doesn't mean that you're without sin. Faith doesn't mean that you don't fall short of God's glory. But faith means that you believe in God, that you do things that make you so that you want to draw near to God. And so faith is the vehicle where we do that. And these men and women had that kind of faith. We're going to talk about Rahab as one of those women tonight. She had great faith. And I think Mike did a great job when he was talking about her. But one of the things I wanted to point out is that so at this point, we've seen Abel and Noah and Abraham, Sarah, and more. We've seen these people. And they're familiar stories, accounts for the Hebrew readers. The whole point, again, of this chapter is just show that they persevered. But what about us? What do these accounts do for us, these accounts? And I like to use the word account instead of stories, because really they're not stories, they're histories. So I like to use that word account a little bit better. But you know, some newer Christians, we were in class and we were talking about some Old Testament stuff. And one of the Christians says, one of the younger Christians, new Christian, says, well, why do I care about this? Why do I care about the Old Testament? And why, you know, and really you get to the book of Hebrews and we're talking about all these Old Testament characters here. And you have to ask yourself, why do we care? And there are two verses in the New Testament, and I'm going to put them on the screen there, that help us understand that. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 6 through 11. I'm not going to read that whole section there, but I'm going to read the bolded part. But Paul is trying to convince his readers in Hebrews that these Old Testament examples were there for a reason. He says, now these things, talking about the things in the Old Testament, became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And so he's talking about Old Testament things. He says, these things became our examples. Now in verse 11 says, these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition on upon whom the ends of the ages have come. And so we look at these things, and they're examples to us. And in this case, if you go back and read the part that I skipped there, they're examples of what not to do. And then Romans chapter 15, verse 4 says, for whatever things were written before were written for our learning. So the Old Testament there is there for a reason. I have a sermon called The Old Testament is Our Friend. And really it is. The whole point for Christians, the whole point of the Old Testament is that we get to see how God deals with his people. And it's not just wrath of God sermons for the Old Testament. God loves his people. God is patient. God is kind. God is long-suffering. And you don't see that anywhere else as much as in the Old Testament. And so going on, it says in Romans 15, they're written for our learning, that we through the patience and comfort of the scriptures might have hope. The Old Testament is supposed to give us hope. And it gives us hope because we can see how God deals with his children Israel. So even some older Christians, though, wonder at the value of the Old Testament. And really, many fail at their Bible reading programs because they get bogged down in the Old Testament thinking, what's this do for me? Spahn, you have a comment there?
I do, Andrew. And good evening to everybody. Yeah, I don't think you can overemphasize what you're saying here about the examples that we have, not just in Hebrews 11, though that certainly is, I think, probably the greatest case, but the examples of people just like you and me. Now, you might not think like we're just like Moses or Abraham or David or Jephthah or any of these people, but we really are. We're flawed, and we have sin in our lives that we're trying to get rid of on a continual basis. We grow, we do good for a while, we make a mistake, we fall. And I think the thing that's the defining factor, like you point out, is that, but are we trusting in God the best we can through the trials that we face? And it's so important to realize that, I think, that these aren't superheroes. They really aren't superheroes. They're men and women. And we
make the mistake of making them, idolizing them.
We do.
Right.
And I think we should definitely say, hey, look, what an example of faith they were. And that's something that all of us is in reach for all of us.
Right.
And not saying that I've got it or you do necessarily, but it's in reach and we can have that just like they do. It's not their abilities that were so tremendous. It was their faith.
Right. And that's the point, I think, is we need examples of faithful men and women.
Yep.
People who are actually walking the walk and you know, they fall down, but they get back up.
Yeah.
Right. And they press on towards the upward calling.
And without the Old Testament, you don't have that.
You're severely limited.
Limited. Yep.
Yeah. So that's the whole point I'm trying to make here, is the Old Testament is our friend in this way. So let's get to the text here. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. By faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did believe when she had received the spies with peace. Mike did a great job of covering verse 31 in his sermon a couple of weeks ago. I told him if I had been there, I wouldn't have wrung his neck, but I wanted to spend a lot of time on this, but I don't have to now. So I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on it, but I want to bring out a few points again. First is not related to Rahab as much, but it says, by faith, the walls of Jericho fell down. Go back and read that statement a couple of times. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down. Whose faith? Wasn't the people in Jericho, it was the Israelites' faith. God told the Israel, you can go back and read the account, but God told the Israelites to march around the city once a day for 6 days. And then on the seventh day, he said, march around the city 7 times. And then when you hear the trumpets blow, you shout with a great shout and the walls will fall down and you can go straight in. Now, what if they'd only gone six times around on Sunday, on that last day, or five times around and then shouted, or, you know, they'd only gone once, or what if they decided to skip Tuesday? But that's not what they did. God said, do this, and the Israelites did that. And Spawn's got a comment already. The whole point is that God said to do it, and they did it, and it happened exactly how he said. Billy, you want to say something?
Yeah, sorry. I was going to say, you know, when's the last time they saw somebody march around a city and the walls fall down?
Never.
I mean, you got to ask yourself that question.
Never.
We've read about it here. Yeah. In this, and so we know it's happened. They never, ever heard about marching around a city for that many times or whatever and blowing trumpets. And the walls fell down. They were totally going by faith. All of them. I don't know what some of them may have been saying. What are we doing this for? I don't think so. But, you know, they trusted God that he was going to do what he said he was going to do.
You know, the crazy thing is that from a psychological factor, this must have been terrifying to the people inside Jericho.
Yeah.
They don't say anything. They just march around the city one time and then they go back to their camp.
Yeah.
And then they come the next day and do it. And they do it for 7 days. And you've got to imagine the fear and everything just mounting inside the city until now they march around it seven times and all of a sudden the walls fall down. I mean, it must have been incredibly
hard. I imagine too, since they, like Rahab, had heard about this God. And so that would amplify their distress, I think, when they were marching around the city.
I know. You can go back to Joshua 2 and you can read what you can go off, Bill. You can go back to Joshua 2 and you can see that the people of the promised land were terrified of the Israelites. The fear that they had in their lives because of it. And Rahab really tells the spies this. They had seen what the Israelites had done to Sihon and Og on the other side of the east side of the Jordan River, in that part of the land, the Amorites. That's who Og and Sihon were. They were Amorites, and they had seen what had happened. But she doesn't say just that. She talks about how God delivered them through the Red Sea, which was 40 years before. Now I made the point to Mike at one point in time. That Rahab probably wasn't even alive when that happened. It's hard to think that she was older than 40 years at the time that she received the spies. And there's a couple of reasons for that. And one of them is that she bears children later on that end up being in the lineage of Jesus. But the thing that I find incredible is that the heightened fear that they had for something that happened so long ago. God, when he judged Israel when he judged Egypt for their cruelty to Israel, he judged them. He crushed their economy. If you go back and read in Exodus, he sent locusts and hail and fire and totally destroyed their crops. He destroyed their economy when he did that. And if you go back and look at each one of the plagues, the easiest one is darkness. Each of the plagues, the blood in the Nile was one of the biggest gods of Egypt. The sun was one of their big gods, Ra. But you can go back and you can, each of those plagues counters, shows God's dominance over some kind of Egyptian god. Not hard because they had hundreds of gods, but even over some of their mighty gods, like Ra and the Nile and Hathor and different ones, Osiris. But he destroyed their religion, or at least discredited it. He destroyed their economy and he destroyed their military. And he did that for a reason. And part of that was so that when the Israelites went into the promised land, that Egypt wouldn't come and bother them for a long, long time. And so that's what Rahab's probably thinking when she mentions the Red Sea crossing. Jehovah delivered Israel in such an incredible way. It was spoken of fearfully 40 years later. That's how incredible that was. It's this fear that convinced Rahab to do what she did. I mean, she went against her own people and against her own country and against her own government. That's what it would have been in Jericho, to hide those spies and to send them out. Both texts leave out what kind of knowledge she had and when she had it, but she must have known why that the Israelites were invading. She knew that God was with them, and she believed that God would win. And that was a godly fear that caused her to hide those spies and to send them out another way, to let them down through the wall and to put that scarlet cord out there and to gather her family with her. And I love that picture. I tried to find one that like the one Mike used. I love that picture because it's the only part of the wall that's standing is her house. And that's the way God would have been. God honored the promise that the people made to Rahab, and God honored Rahab because of that and saved her because of it. And what a great, great story. There are historical letters, actual extra-biblical historical letters found in Egypt, and they're called the Tel El Armana letters. And it's one of the places where the Israelites are first called Habiru or Hebrews. And they're from the Canaanites, and they're sent to the Egyptians, and they're asking for help against these Habiru invaders, help that would never come because Egypt was still recovering. Like I said, and I said again that I don't believe that Rahab was alive. The first reason is because I think she was probably young because she was a harlot. The second is that she married into Judah and bore children. So what are the rewards of Rahab's faith besides getting to live? She got to be one of the three women that are named. There are four in the lineage of Jesus that are mentioned, but three women that are named in the lineage of Jesus. Matthew chapter 1, verses 3 through 6 says, Judah begot Perez and Zerah by Tamar. There's one of them. Perez begot Hezron, and Hezron begot Ram. Ram begot Amminadab. Amminadab begot Nahshon, and Nahshon begot Salmon. Salmon begot Boaz by Rahab. Boaz begot Obed by Ruth, and Obed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David the king. So you've got this, that's one great honor that she got. Because of her faith, she actually married into the tribe of Judah, and the one on the bottom there, Numbers chapter 3, she actually became a princess basically in Judah because of her faith. And Numbers chapter 3, and I say that because Nahshon was the son of Abinadab, but if you look at it, it says on the east side, toward the rising of the sun, those of the standard of the forces with Judah shall camp according to their armies, and Nahshon, the son of Amminadab, shall be the leader of the children of Judah. And it's Nahshon's son, Salmon, that marries Rahab and begat Boaz. And if you understand that relationship, It also gives us a little bit of an idea, or gives us some color in the story of Ruth, why he was so willing to accept a foreign woman as a wife. His mother was a foreign woman, and so she got to marry a prince, which is kind of a cool thing. So anyway, Rahab is mentioned twice here and in James about her faith. What great faith that she had. So let's move on. He goes on in verse 32, and what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, and turned to flight the armies of aliens. So what more can I say, the author is saying here. He says, if I had time, I would tell you all about these other guys. But I'm just going to mention them by name, as basically he's doing. We'll just briefly review some of them. Gideon, He was a judge. You could read about him in Judges chapter 6 and 7. Oh, Spahn's got a comment. Go ahead, Bill, before I get going. Go ahead.
Yeah, before you get into the details there. You know, what a landscape of people he's going to talk about here.
Right.
And it wasn't because of their great abilities. It wasn't because of they were, you know, something necessarily special. It was, it says, by faith they did these things. Yep. Not because they were geniuses. Not because they happened to be maybe the best soldier in the line. You know, it was their confidence in God that as they stepped up and made the choice to serve him the way he called them to do, he gave them the victory. So, yeah. And because of their confidence in him, he's the one who actually gave them, you know, the reward and the victory in all these cases. So yeah, sometimes, again, we kind of think these were special people because they had special talents. No, they trusted God.
A perfect example is that the story of Gideon, right? Gideon calls out, he calls out Israel. They come and God looks at him and says, way too many people here.
Yeah.
Why did God say that? Because he wanted to give them the victory.
Yes.
He wanted to make it absolutely clear that he was the one doing it. And so he said, tell whoever's scared to go home, and 10,000 or so left. And then take them down to the water, and those that lap water one way are good, and those that don't, send them all home. He sends everyone but 300 men home against a number that says was unnumberable. Yeah. The Midianites were more than the sands of the sea. It didn't actually say it that way, but it says you couldn't number them. And they had camels and donkeys and all of that. Right. And God took 300 men and used those 300 men to destroy all of the Midianites.
And so the point being on all these examples is not that there's something particularly special. And because he could have named a lot more, he said, he could have, you know, time will fail me.
Yep.
It's that this is the way it is for everyone who trusts in God.
Yeah.
Trust in God, and God will work in your life the things, his purpose, the way he wants it to be.
Yeah.
And that to me, just that's how you bring it home to, I think, to you and me, is this is talking about our potential here.
Right. He's actually, if you go through here, you could count how many people. There are less than 30 people in this chapter. Mm-hmm. But in chapter 12, verse 1, it says, we're surrounded by a cloud of witnesses. Yeah. So many people, and I've got that itchy nose thing going on again.
Maybe it's me. I don't know.
Maybe it's you. I don't know. I rub my nose here with a Kleenex, see if it'll go away. Okay. Thank you, Bill. So we just talked about Gideon. Jeff said yes, whatever that means. I'm not sure what that means. We just talked about Gideon and how his 300 men were, God led, it's Bill's fault, that 300 men, he led 300 men against all those Midianites, and God took care of it. And he did the faith that, now think about that. Think about the faith that it did require on Gideon's part to go ahead and surround those Midianites with his 300 men with their trumpets and their torches inside the jugs. And it took faith to step out and to do that. Barak, Judges chapter 4, led Israel into battle against Sisera, but he wouldn't go without Deborah. And Deborah said, because you have to have a woman here, it's going to be a woman who saves the day in battle. And she's actually the one who kills, Jael is the one who kills Sisera by driving a tent peg through his skull. Samson, Judges chapter 13 through 17, a judge that doesn't get much credit. But it was his job to provoke the Philistines. If you go back and read about it, Samson doesn't get much respect. I know people call him a buffoon, call him a clown or whatever, but he's right here. He's right here in what we would call the hall of faith. God said that he had faith. And you can go read the story, and it says in the end, he killed more Philistines in his death than when he lived. When he took down the temple of Dagon with all the people partying in it. And so, you know, here is Samson in this group. And he goes on and says, Jephthah. And we think about Jephthah's bad vow and all that entails. We get stuck on the fact, but we forget that Jephthah was a great man of faith too. I mean, he went out and asked God to deliver these people into his hands with the faith that God would do it. And God did it. It doesn't mention Joshua here, who asked God to literally stop the sun and the moon in the sky so that he could pursue God's enemies. And God listened to him. It says God hasn't done that for any other man. What kind of faith does it take to sit there and say, God, could you just, I want to get this job done for you. Can you just stop the sun and give me a longer day? And God did it. That's the kind of faith that these guys had. God would either tell them to do something and they would do it, or God, like in Gideon's case or Barak's case or, going on, they had such faith that they believed that God would do anything through them, like David. You could look at David and Samuel. We could spend weeks on those two alone. The idea that David would go up against Goliath is just such a great amount of faith on his part that God would deliver Goliath into his hands because he was disrespecting God. David subdued kingdoms. He had absolute faith in God. Samuel was righteous, and he was the final judge of Israel. You've got prophets. It mentions prophets here, but I'm going to mention a few by name. Elijah, Elisha, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Amos, Obadiah, Jeremiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, you could get them all, right? But each of the lies stood up to those who would dismiss God or belittle God. Take Elijah, for instance. He battled against Ahab and Jezebel. Go back and look at the account where he goes against the priests of Baal and Asherah on Mount Carmel. That's the candy. Mount Carmel. He goes against them, one against all of those other priests. And he had faith in God that God would not only deliver him, but that God would take care of him, and God would, in the end, he asked God for the fire and God gave it to him. Each of these stood up to false teachers. Each of them proclaimed the goodness and the deliverance of God. Go back and read Jeremiah, go back and read Isaiah, any of the prophets that God sends to Israel or sends to Judah and says, repent. They stood up to false teachers. And not only that, many of these men were persecuted for the kingdom of God. Think of Samson, who had his eyes put out and was made a slave, or Elijah, who was pursued by Jezebel and Ahab, Elisha, who was persecuted by the Israelite kings, David, who Saul tried to kill numerous times. You've got these men that had the faith to do the job. Verse 33 says, through faith, subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the enemies of the aliens, or armies of the aliens. This is the lesson of verse 33. And I pay attention because I think it's important. Their faith made them strong. Each of these things here, their faith made them strong. Look at the words used here. Their faith allowed them to subdue kingdoms, to work righteousness, to obtain promises, to stop the mouths of lions. By the way, that applies to Samson and David and Daniel. All of them at one point or another stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire. Think of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They had an opportunity to walk away from that, to walk back because Nebuchadnezzar, when he was told that they didn't bow down, they had an opportunity to bow down. But they chose not to. They chose to have faith in God. And I love what I believe it's Shadrach who says. He says, whether or not God delivers us, know, O king, that we will not bow down to the idol that you've presented. And that just makes Nebuchadnezzar so mad. He says, heat that thing up 10 times. And so they, I think it's 10 times, but he says, heat that thing, that furnace up even hotter. And the guys, the strong men who took Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to throw them in to the fire, they died because it was so hot. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, I think is the name, their Hebrew names, they didn't die. What faith they had. Escape the edge of the sword. You could look at Elijah. I mean, how many times did Ahab and Jezebel try to kill Elijah? How many times did the kings try to kill Elisha? But Elisha looked out and he could see that there were chariots of angels protecting him. And that's when he asked that God would open his servant's eyes so the servant could see the same thing he saw. Out of weakness were made strong. You could think of David, the ruddy youth going up against the Philistine Goliath, who was 9 feet tall. But isn't this just about all of us? The weak being strong. Paul asked that the problem, his thorn in the flesh, be taken away. And Jesus said something to him. He said that in my weakness, strength is in your weakness, strength is perfected. And I'm paraphrasing that, but the idea is that God is our strength. God is our perfection, and all we have to do is provide the faith to get there. So each of these phrases, I think, are designed to light a fire in the hearts of the Hebrews. And we need to be familiar enough of the Old Testament to be reminded as well that these men and women they're heroes because they were faithful. They were still flawed, but they're heroes because of their faith. And we can be the same kind of hero. We can be the same. We can have the same kind of faith. It was through their faith that they accomplished all these great deeds. And the Hebrews could do the same thing, and we can do the same thing. The next slide says women, and there's an odd break here. In my text, actually, verse 35, the first part of it's in the prior paragraph, and then this paragraph actually starts with others, and I don't understand that. So I put 35 with this paragraph. Women received their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trials of mockings and scourgings, yes, of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted, were slain with a sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. I have a picture of Elijah here, supposedly being fed by ravens. And this is after the battle on Mount Carmel. I don't know why. I don't know why I want to say Carmel. Mount Carmel. And he's fled from the face of Jezebel because she said that she's going to kill him. And he goes and he hides near a spring, and God sends ravens to feed him. That's the idea that's the kind of people we're talking about here. People who thought that they were alone in the battle. And what did God tell them? I have yet 7,000 who have not knelt down to Baal. I've reserved those to myself. So we've got this passage. The author is close to finishing his argument here in chapter 11. He's trying to finish his argument, his encouragement for them to stay the course. He said, women received their dead raised to life again. Elijah raised the widow of Zarephath's son. You can go look at 1 Kings 17. Elisha raised the son of the Shunammite woman. You can go look at 2 Kings 4. Jesus raised the widow of Nain's son, not Old Testament, obviously, but in both these examples, the women had faith to ask the prophets. They also had the faith to ask the prophets for help. They had the faith to help the prophets, and they had the faith to ask the prophets for help when they needed it. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. And now I've got a quote, I've got the actual quote from Daniel chapter 3. It's not on the board, but Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods, nor will we worship the golden image which you have set up. They did not accept deliverance. They could have bowed out. Oh, Spahn had a comment three minutes ago. What's your comment, Bill?
Oh, that's right. It would fit in anywhere here. But actually, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were delivered from that fiery furnace.
Sure, but they're
talking about a section of people that may not be delivered. They were tortured. Yeah. They were sawn in two. I don't think you walk away when you're sawn in two. So how many people were thrown into a fiery furnace that didn't survive, but they trusted God for deliverance? And, of course, that would be an eternal deliverance, a heavenly kingdom. And we've got both examples. We've got examples that up to verse 34 of the victory and the power and the success and all these great things that God gives those that live by faith. And then that also goes over to the part where the suffering that can come and those willing to endure it who trust in God will receive a great reward.
Yeah.
And of course, Jesus is our ultimate example there, right? He's just, he laid his life down and,
Which is actually the part of first part of chapter 12, right?
Yeah, there you go. I won't get too far ahead. That's all I wanted to say was that you've got people who died. That was what their faith led them to. They were tortured and they were killed.
Yeah, the reason that I put Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in here again is that they didn't accept the deliverance that Nebuchadnezzar offered them.
Yeah,
he said, "Bow down." It's kind of funny because he had. I think that he knew that they were Daniel's friends. He had appointed them to high offices in his administration. So I think I get the idea that he probably liked them. He gave them a second chance. Mm-hmm. And they didn't accept that chance. They said, you know, God can save us if he wants to, but just know this, we're not going to bow down. Yeah. And so that's what I was thinking about not accepting deliverance. But you're right, they were tortured. You can think about, and I don't know why I don't have it right here. Oh, yeah, I've got it. Jeremiah, thrown into a slime pit that he couldn't sit down in, you know, all sorts of things. These guys were beat up, stoned, sawn in two. You're right. The faith that it took to go through those kind of tortures, just like Jesus. So, okay. Jeremiah being tortured by thrown in a slime pit. The Bible doesn't tell us how most of the prophets died. It suggested that Isaiah is the one that was sawn in two by King Manasseh. That's extra biblical. I think it's Josephus who says that. Extra biblically, not necessarily, traditionally. Jeremiah was stoned in Egypt. Ezekiel was killed in Babylon. We are told that Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, the priest, was stoned. That's 2 Chronicles 24:21. And we know that Stephen was stoned in Acts chapter 7. So the idea that they were tortured or not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. They accepted the things that were coming towards them or coming to them because they looked beyond the short term. Just like we'll see in chapter 12, Jesus, for the joy set before him, endured the cross. We need to have the same kind of joy. And that's really a lesson for chapter 12. But we need to have the same kind of joy, the same kind of goal, that we need to look beyond because we're trying to obtain a better resurrection. So it says, of whom the world was not worthy. This is God's view of these men and women. God looks down and And you could look at Elijah, this guy on the screen here. He's a bum, right? He's dressed in rough clothing. In fact, it says sheepskin. Do I have that in here? I think I skipped that. I did. Dressed in sheepskin. That's John the Baptist. He dressed in with a leather belt and a hairy shirt and people looked down on him because he was running around in the wilderness. But what did God think of John? Jesus said, "There's no one greater than John." He said, "But everyone in the church is greater than he is." But he was saying, "Of men, there's no one greater than John the Baptist." God looks at these people as being worthwhile. They're the salt that he looks for in the earth, the ones that give the earth flavor, the ones that allow him to palate, to the earth to be palatable to him. But he looks at them that's God's view, is that the world is not worthy of those people of faith or of people of faith. And it's really not, because the world's not our home, for one thing. We're just passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. I think we sing that song, right? The idea is that this whole physical realm the people on this ball of you know, on this ball floating through space, it's not worthy of us, whether the world is talking about the physical world or the people in the world. They're not worthy of the people of faith. That's God's view. Their faith allowed them to do great things, and their faith allowed them to suffer greatly too. And the world is not worthy of them. The world might not even think much about them, but they are highly valued by God, is what I want to say. And think about this: when you are beset with trials and tribulations, when because of God you're surrounded by those who would do you harm, that you are highly valued by God. The world isn't worthy of you, and it's not worthy of the Hebrews that were faithful either. They were faithful, and God looks at them and says, "That's what I want to see." They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. You'll find a number of examples of this in Scripture, but Elijah and John the Baptist immediately come to mind. The idea here is they had no real home, at least not in this life. This, again, echoes the idea that we're looking for a home in heaven. So you've got this group of people, and I really think that the point of this is verse 38. That the world wasn't worthy of them, but God loved them. So let's go on. All these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. So this is the end of the matter, the big comparison. And Downey said I wouldn't get to the end of chapter 11, but he was wrong. But this is the end of the matter. Like I said, the big comparison. They had faith, but they didn't receive the fulfillment of the promise. And I've got an exclamation mark in my notes there. They didn't receive it. They had the faith to do all these things, looking for a better place, looking for a city that God made, looking for all these things, and they didn't receive the fulfillment of that promise. They did in the long run, but they didn't get it in their lifetime, is what this means. They lived and they died, and sometimes in grisly ways, and they did not receive the inheritance. Like Abraham, he had to buy his own grave. He had to buy a place where he could bury Sarah. He had to, and Isaac was no better. Isaac, even though his inheritance was the land, he didn't receive the land. Neither did Jacob, neither did Joseph. But it was, you know, a couple hundred years later, and there's a reason why I say that, but a couple hundred years later, the Israelites come in and they receive the land. So you've got that. That's the idea, is that these guys, they lived and they died and they didn't receive their inheritance because they were looking for a country, a homeland, a city, and they wouldn't receive that until Jesus Christ died for them. And so they're looking, again, that's, I think, the point of this, is they did not receive the promise. They did once Jesus died for their sins, but when they were living, they didn't receive it. They received blessings, but they didn't receive the ultimate promise they were looking for. This is the kind of faith they had. History records their testimony, how faithful they were. The Bible records just how faithful Joseph was, just how faithful Daniel was, just how faithful Jacob was, even though he was a cheater sometimes. The Bible records all that. Bill, you have a comment?
Yeah, the way I look at this too is that they didn't, I mean, we live with the king and the kingdom after he's come and established that kingdom. And right. They had to look forward to that. It was promised to them. We live in the age of that fulfilled kingdom with the Christ already having made the sacrifice. So all those things that often we just take for granted, you know, they were looking forward to that.
Right.
And it didn't happen during their day. And so without us, without our part in actually living during this time, where we do have that promise fulfilled, they're made perfect or complete. Their faith has been completed in what we see now in Christ having come to the earth.
Yep, that's actually that's the point of verse 40, right? Yeah. That God having provided something better for us, we look back to the cross, they look forward to the cross. Because we're looking back, it's already been fulfilled for us. Yeah. We can see that promise. We can see what's in store for us. We get to see all of that because he's provided something better for us. But the point is that they're made perfect, not apart from us, but with us.
Yeah.
It's the same event that they're made perfect through and was better for us. That's the whole point of verse 4. Yeah, excellent, excellent thoughts. So, I've got in my notes that the faithful in this chapter look forward to that. But the Hebrews, the ones that it's being written to, could look back and see the fulfillment of that promise. And believe it or not, the Hebrews in this day and age, the one that is being written to, they have it easier than Abraham had it because they get to see the fulfillment of it. It's a hindsight thing. They get to look back and see that it's already fulfilled. So we actually have it easier because we get to see the whole story. I think it should be easier for us. So maybe that means that we're going to be judged more harshly when the time comes because we do have it easier. God provided something better for us. The church is one thing. Heaven, because we have Jesus Christ, we get to go to heaven. They didn't get to go to heaven until Jesus Christ died for their sins. So together we might be made perfect or complete. Both together, inheriting the same promise made possible by Jesus Christ. So do you have that kind of faith? Do the Hebrews have that kind of faith? That's the point of chapter 11. So that actually brings us to chapter 12, and I still have 3 minutes left. So at the end of, I don't know if we'll get that far into chapter 12, but at the end of chapter 10, we were told that the just live by faith. Chapter 11, we're told without faith is impossible to please him. And the author provides us with example after example of faithful men and women. In chapter 12, we see what our response to that is. So let's just read chapter 12, the first couple of verses. And we're not going to get very far into this, but it says, "Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and every sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race set before us, looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. This is the bookend to what we've been talking about. Always look at therefore, right, as a looking back statement. Therefore, we also, just since the just live by faith, since it's impossible to please God without faith, since we have all these great examples, therefore, because of all this, the author wants two things of us. He wants us to lay aside the weight of sin, and he wants us to run with endurance the race set before us. That's what he's telling the Hebrews here. Now, my clock says 9 o'clock, so that's what we have to look forward to. Chapter 12, I think chapter 12 will breeze pretty quickly. It's a great chapter, but it's our response to the question of faith. What's required of us because of faith? And I think that chapter 12 gives us that answer. So go ahead and read it, and we'll study it in 2 weeks. Thank you for your time.